This episode is brought to you by Summer School Electronics. With pedals like the Snow Day Delay, the Pep Rally Fuzz, the Trash Panda, and my personal favorite, the Science Fair, which is two classic dirt pedals in one with a mid-boosted overdrive on one side, a black lab rat circuit on the other, and a blend knob to blend between them to find the perfect classic stacked dirt sound you're looking for, it's hard not to find something you'll love. Mark builds all of his pedals by hand in Syracuse, New York, where he also works as a full-time educator. In addition to the super fun graphics on their pedals, Mark also offers custom artwork. Want your dog's face on a pedal? He can do it. Want your face on a pedal? He can make that happen too. Go over to summerschoolelectronics.com and make sure to tell them that 40 Watt Podcast sent you. Philip, 40 Watt Podcast, coming at you again. I am super pumped for today's episode, but I'm going to do a couple of things out of order from the way that I normally do things. I have been told that I should mention these things at the beginning instead of at the end. So we're gonna mention a couple of housekeeping things at the beginning before we get into chat with our guest today that I'm super pumped about. Obviously, you can see the screen. You've seen the episode title, so you know what's going on. Remember to go find the podcast on Facebook, Instagram. I even made a page over on The Jump that JHS and Rhett Schull are using now. I don't know that it'll stay there, but I figured why not. Remember, you can find and support the podcast on Patreon. We really appreciate that. I do donate 25% of everything that comes through Patreon to charities like St. Jude, Delta Blues Museum Arts and Education Program, and I'm actively looking for other charities that would be a great place to donate as Patreon grows. You can email us at 40wattpodcast@gmail.com. Send me your ideas. Send me your tips. If you want to be on the show, send me an email. I'll talk to you. We'll see what's going on. So otherwise, I really appreciate all the support. The YouTube channel is up and running, so you may be watching this on YouTube now. Really appreciate it. Hit subscribe. Hit the bell icon. If you are listening to the audio version of the podcast, please rate and review us wherever you are doing that. Now, with all of that out of the way, I don't have to say it at the end like usual. I'm super pumped. Today, I'm talking to guitarist, singer, songwriter Ariel Posen from all the way up in probably not so cold Canada these days. It's probably starting to warm up for y'all.
It's getting there. Yeah. You know, it's unpredictable, you know. We can sometimes have winter literally till May.
Oh man, no,
that doesn't. And it's pretty nice. Yeah, we're in plus. I mean, we're in Celsius, so you know we're already in like anywhere between 5 to 10 degrees. It's going to get warmer this weekend. So for us, we're in flip flops and shorts already. And we're at the beach.
No. That's way too much for this Mississippi boy. It's not for me. We actually got some record breaking snow this year, and it was too much. I'm like, no, this is good.
When you just live it your whole life and you're prepared for it, it's a bit of a different experience.
Oh, absolutely. So I'm super pumped to have you on. It's one of those things where I shot an Instagram message off and didn't even think twice about it. And next thing I know, you messaged me back. You're like, yeah, I'll do it. That'd be awesome. So I really appreciate you coming on. So disclaimer, I tried to do the journalistic thing. I tried to do the research thing, like, oh, I'm going to try to ask questions he's never been asked before. I'm going to watch videos, listen to interviews. It'll be great. Dude, your output is incredible on YouTube. And like, you have your own channel. So you do your own YouTube channel that you post things to every now and again. I don't know just how regular that is. But I've seen you on several shows, several either podcasts or video channels lately. There's a lot out there. How do you find the time to do all of this stuff and put out a pretty incredible record that just came out?
Thank you, first of all. You just make time. These days, what we would call in the industry is press or promo is kind of an essential part of the puzzle that you have to make time for if you want to, you know, put your reach out as much as you can. So there's a lot of that. I mean, when touring is a thing, like when life is normal, try to mix in touring and doing that kind of stuff too. Like often I'm on tour and before the gig, I'm dragging my band to do a live session somewhere, or I have to run across town to do some kind of interview or something. Honestly, it's just, it's not like it's crazy. I can speak on behalf of all my friends and colleagues. They do the same thing. You know, you just have to do it. Yeah. So it's about prioritizing. It's about being organized. And yeah, in terms of content, I've always been putting stuff out and I've always been mindful of that stuff. It's just, like now this past year, I guess I've just cranked it just a bit, like, you know, for my YouTube and knowing that I was going to put out an album without actually touring. So I was like, you know, I better back this up with a bit more content than I usually would. Tried to get creative. So just about evolving with the times. And yeah, I mean, you know, you can't just put yourself out there and expect that to do the work for you. You have to keep getting the word out somehow, I guess.
Yeah.
And I'm fortunate that, you know, I have a lot of connections, that I know a lot of people that want to have me on these kind of things that you've probably seen me on. Like, that doesn't go unnoticed, and I'm very grateful for that. But at the same time, you know, I have a whole team that is hustling for it, that kind of stuff too. So it's a big team effort, and you just got to make the time and make the effort to be organized and make it all happen, even when you're sick of it. When you're sick of answering the same question a million times, that's just the game.
Even when you're tired of it. Yeah. In fact, that's actually, so I recently saw your rig rundown with Premier Guitar.
Right.
So that actually is awesome. I get to reference that video. I'm going to link that video down below. We don't have to go through your whole rig. Like, I know, like, if we're a guitar podcast mostly, we talk to a few other musicians. We talk about gear for a large portion of it, but
nice. You know,
I have some place I get to ask you some other things. Like, in that video, you talked about referencing this year when this all happened. You know, suddenly you realize you weren't going to be on the road. You're putting out an album that isn't going to get that kind of tour support that you would normally have. But in that video, you also said it was a little hard to, when it all initially happened, it was a little tough to kind of find the groove to get into writing, to find that mindset to get into the writing. What was that like going into a pandemic, a lockdown, however people want to phrase it, a quarantine, and trying to get your mind wrapped around writing an album that you wouldn't get to tour?
Well, the album was recorded before.
Oh, wow.
Before the quarantine, yeah, before the pandemic started. So the plan, it actually worked out okay in that regard. Like, the plan was record the album December. If there's any bits beginning of January we need to do, we'll finish it up. And then I was on tour January, February, till a few days before the pandemic. I was in the States, I was in the UK, and I was in Sweden. And I had a couple Canadian shows too. My last show was in Thunder Bay, Ontario, March 7th. And then my plan was to actually just take off a couple of months, because just at home, we were doing a couple things that just required, you know, just life things. I just was taking some time off. It had been really busy. And the plan was no gigs, but we're going to mix the record then. And Kean Reardon, who mixed the record, is in L.A., so, I mean, like, it's not like I was going to be there. It was all going to be remotely, which is standard. That's how it goes. So we did that. That was exactly how it would have been. So, like, making the album, finishing it, that was all good in the pandemic. It was just after that, like, I probably signed off on everything and masters, everything by maybe May or June, like, committed to it. And then I think I was just so burnt out. I wasn't feeling creative. I wasn't feeling inspired, because I just put all this time and energy into finishing this album. I didn't know what the future was looking like we were all feeling like that. So it took me a while, but then I started feeling inspired again to write around end of September. And it's been pretty heavy onset since then, which is great. Writing for me, I can't force it. it kind of just needs to happen. And I need to be in that mindset. So I'm glad it happened. It took a while, but hey, it's okay.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. Yeah, there's that whole, there's two approaches to songwriting I've discovered in my years of tackling that beast. And there's the Nashville, you just sit down every day and you write until it comes out. And then there's the inspired approach. It's like, it's gotta happen sort of organically, a little naturally with the song coming to you a little bit. And it's interesting to see how maybe the music that we're starting to see coming out just in general is influenced by the pandemic and no touring and people writing maybe a little differently. It'll be interesting to see what overtones in music are in the next year or two as people, like, the songs from this time period continue to start to come out.
Yeah. I mean, here's the thing. I mean, the Nashville people you refer to, that's their job.
Yeah.
In fact, exactly. I write with people whose job is, you know, I have a publishing deal and I write songs all day. They co-write maybe two or three co-writes a day. That's their job. So even if you're not inspired, you have to just think about, hey, doesn't matter if I'm not inspired. It's just, but like they train their brains. That's what they do. You know, it's not it's not even what they do. It's who they are. They're just always thinking of ideas. That's for me. I write a lot with other people for other people. Like, hey, Ariel, can you want to get together and write? I'm trying to get some new songs for a pro. Sure. Like, I'm happy to write for other people. I love that. But for myself, writing for myself, I can't just make a cup of coffee in the morning and say, well, I'm going to write something today. We'll see what happens. I can sit down and just like mess around. And if something kind of hits me that I think has potential, then I can maybe move forward. But I can't just force myself into writing. I have to be inspired. I have to just have an idea.
No, it makes sense. And, I have some friends of mine who are Nashville songwriters, and they talk about that transition when they first got into that, like learning that mindset. Like it was awkward at first, but once they had done it for a while, it was like it becomes second nature. I don't know that I could do it, but it's one of those things you learn to do. So I'm fascinated by songwriters. I've always been. It's one of those things that as a guitar player coming up, people would ask me, who was I listening to? What guitar players was I inspired by? And I would always answer, I'm not. Guitar players weren't who I listened to. I listened to songwriters more than anything. So I'd learned to play guitar for songs, not learn to play guitar. And so I'm fascinated by the process of songwriting just in general, because I know how much I struggle with it. So you've got these new songs. You've got this. You've been doing a lot of recording videos for your music lately, because obviously not touring. So you were pretty active on YouTube before. So it wasn't much of a transition for you putting stuff just ramping up what you were doing on YouTube.
First of all, pardon me. I've been on YouTube since like 2006.
Yeah,
I've been putting video. Most of them are private now. Like I threw most of them away, but I've been doing that. I was putting videos of myself playing guitar long before Instagram. So like when all this stuff started happening, I was like, oh, I guess it's just accepted now to just promote yourself that way. I just, you know, I didn't feel like a lot of people did it then. The last few years, you know, I've been somewhat active on my YouTube, but not crazy. Like my first record, I made sure I had like a live video for each song that I put out on my record, maybe an alternate version. I did this Familiar Ground record, which was like a YouTube concert. And then for this album, I was like, okay, people like the live videos. Let's make sure I have, basically every song filmed. Maybe I'll make some lyric videos. How can I make a lyric video interesting and engaging more than just a visualizer? Well, why don't we get the band and we'll just make it more of a performance lyric video. And then I was like, well, what else can I do? How about I break down, and I'm not the first to do this. Like I've seen a lot of other people do it too. Like, why don't I just make videos breaking down each song that comes out and like how I made it and like what goes in, because I'm interested in seeing that kind of stuff when bands do it. So like, I'll just do that. And you know what? I like to be funny. I like to be silly. Like, I'll just make it funny and fun, you know? Like, obviously the stuff is serious, but I don't take myself seriously. I mean, all the years I was doing Anderton videos, what we do is try to push a product as much as we can, play nicely in terms of like the music side. But otherwise we're just acting like idiots. We're just like taking ourselves not seriously. And that stuff is genuine. That's how we are. We're just like a bunch of silly people.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was just coming across my mind. It's like, you know what? I'm not going to go harder on it. I'm just going to try it out and do more of it. And like when things go back to normal, I know a lot of my friends who have started going deeper into YouTube are going to leave that behind and not keep it going. But I think a lot will. For me, it won't change. Like, I think it's just important to have that stuff.
We'll be right back.
This podcast is supported in part by String Joy Strings. I'm a snob, at least that's what people tell me. I'm never okay with good enough, and that's where String Joy Strings come in. They're better than good enough. They're the best. String Joy are making some of the finest strings available today right up the road from me in Nashville, Tennessee. They offer custom sets, balanced tension, coated strings, the works. If you need it, they can probably make it happen. You should be using String Joy Strings, and if you're going to order from them, you really could help this podcast out by clicking the affiliate link down in the description or show notes below. You get amazing strings, I get a little bit of that back to help the show keep going. It's a win-win situation. Get your String Joy Strings today.
It's part of your package, you know?
Yeah, and I think more so now than ever, people are having to... This podcast was born out of... I wasn't playing shows anymore. I wasn't playing, you know, I wasn't even just getting together to jam with friends anymore. I needed some connection to music again somehow. So I just started talking to musicians. Actually, at first I was just talking about music and the music industry. And then I started interviewing folks and just had a blast doing it. And this is how I felt connected again to it. It's one of those things that it'll continue.
Yeah.
So, you know, you find the outlet that keeps you plugged in, and then there'll be a lot of artists that have to make a decision whether or not it's something they want to continue as part of their normal press PR or even just connecting to fans.
For sure.
And so you brought up Anderton's. That's actually how I first discovered you as a musician, was through the Anderton's videos. And right. Then there was the tie into the Bros, Brothers Landreth, that I discovered. But what I don't know, and it's probably been covered in videos before, so this is going to be one of those questions you've answered before. But what I don't know, how to go back, young Ariel, how'd you get into music? How'd you find guitar? Like, what was your story getting started in music?
Well, both my parents are musicians, and they were traveling, touring in a band. So, I mean, my whole childhood was going on airplanes, going to festivals, going to theaters, going to shows, hanging out at the studio while they were making records. So, I mean, like, that was just my upbringing. So, you know, at six, I started piano. By the time I was like 7 or 8, already knew I wanted to play guitar, started, never looked back. It was just normal. Like, it's just a family where generationally, like, everyone is musicians.
Yeah.
So it was just, it's in the blood.
Yeah. There was no like, you know, aha moment or Aurora or Aurora, Eureka, where it's like, oh, guitar, this is what I want to do. It's just, it came very naturally as part of growing up for you.
Exactly. Yeah. I didn't even know that I wanted to do it, you know, as a job when I was younger. It was just what I did. And then when I got older, well, when I was in high school, it just started becoming very apparent. Like, I was 14 years old when I first got paid for a gig, and I started playing gigs with, like, here is $50 for this coffee, for this tea party you played in a backyard for two, you know what I mean? Something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah,
I was exactly. Like, wait a minute, I can make money doing this. This is insane. This is what I should probably be doing. And I had many other jobs, like we all do when we're in our teens.
Sure.
And it just made sense.
No, that's awesome.
So I did it.
I, it's Do you feel like your parents just sort of expected you to do it? Was there ever any push to learn an instrument? Or For example, I interviewed Alice Hasen, who is a violinist in the Memphis area, and her mom is she's from Vermont. Her mom was a member of the Vermont Orchestra. You know, it's like she grew up in a musical household, and like there was just, she told the story of there came a day where it was like, all right, Alice, now's the time for you to learn to, you know, pick an instrument. What are you going to play?
Right. No, I mean, it was encouraged that we started on piano. Like my brother took piano too, but then after that, he's very musical, but he never really learned an instrument or took it seriously. He's kind of like, he can play a few songs on guitar. He can play a bunch of songs on the piano, and he could back anyone up. Like he can play piano, but he never really got the bug to like to like learn an instrument properly to sound sophisticated.
Sure.
You know? But yeah, it was encouraged. And then we just ran with it. I mean, if I said, I really don't like this, I really don't want to play piano or guitar, they would have said, no problem.
Yeah.
Like it was encouraged. It wasn't forced.
Oh, that's awesome.
And being a musician as a job was definitely, it wasn't encouraged. It wasn't forced. It was supported though, because it was my decision.
Yeah. It's because that's a big leap, especially for those that are already, your parents being in the industry and playing music for a living. They know it's not an easy road. It's not an easy life to get exactly on the road, months and months out of the year. I tell friends all the time, I left, I don't play music for a living anymore. I never did on any big scale, but I still have friends who are doing it, and it's a hard life. It's not easy. You've got to constantly be on. I dare say it is much harder than the average 9-to-5, and people don't always believe me. It's more rewarding in a lot of ways.
I mean, it's one thing if you're a touring musician. That's where I think it kind of gets the toughest, just being away. You know, if you got stuff at home, it's tough. But if you're a local cat working, you know, working gigs weekly, there's a way to manage that to really make it work. And I did that for years and years and years. That's how I cut my teeth. Again, there's like the future isn't as paved as a 9-to-5. If you don't get your schedule, you know, here's the July schedule. Oh, I got Tuesdays off. It's not like that. It'll always be different. And you got to hustle. You got to make things happen for yourself. And no one's out there that's going to do you favors. You kind of got to make those things happen. So, yeah, it is tough either way you spell it. But I do believe that those that are driven and want to work will work. It's about what you put in and not waiting for the phone to ring and not waiting to see who's going to email you. Just got to keep moving forward and making those connections and opportunities happen for yourself in whatever way that can be.
Sure. No, that makes total sense. The work is out there if you want to go after it. It's going to be interesting as we're easing out of the pandemic and this very isolated lifestyle as musicians get back on the road. I think I actually saw Government Mule just announce their first dates in like 15 months. So a friend of mine messaged me that he was almost in tears. He was so excited. Government Mule's back on the road. So that's how I know that. But it's going to be interesting because there's going to be a whole lot of musicians trying to get out on the road at the same time and hitting these venues. And there's going to be a bit of a log jam as folks try to find dates and try to find places to play. Have you started to book anything for an upcoming tour, anything yet? Started to look at that?
We'll be right back.
If you love good music and good podcasts, you'll love Roots Music Rambler. I'm Jason Falls. My co-host Francesca Folinazzo and I talk to the singers, songwriters, musicians, and more in Americana, alt-country, bluegrass, folk, blues, and beyond. We share our own takes on the latest news in the space and recommend new music for you to explore every episode. Come get to the roots of the music you love. Find us at RootsMusicRambler.com or go wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe to Roots Music Rambler.
Yeah, I mean, I still have dates this year that spilled over from last year. I do have stuff in 2022. I'm just like, we're still holding off on announcing anything because there's still so much uncertainty, and in a way, it feels kind of naive to just and kind of cocky to announce dates now when we still really don't know if there could be another wave and everything can shut down again.
Sure.
So I'm trying to stay like cautiously optimistic, but hard to say. I do think as weird of a transition it was when everything shut down and all the gigs got canceled, all the venues shut down, it's going to be just as equally weird, if not stranger and tougher, when it all opens up again and when these shows go back to normal.
Right.
I anticipate every emotion and every obstacle coming out of the woodwork, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Just from the artists, from the bands, and from the venues, the promoter. It's just going to be a lot. It's going to be weird. It's going to be difficult. But it'll also be great once it does go back to normal. I think everyone's going to have a big appreciation. I love the fact that your friend was in tears seeing that. That gives me hope that people are just so excited for music to come back in a live capacity.
Oh, I think
it'll take a minute though. You know, like
it won't feel normal. It won't feel normal at first. It'll feel very awkward. Even I think that's going to linger for a little while too. I think even after, the fear subsides, after the danger is gone, after whether that's through immunization, better understanding, whatever it is that gets us to a point where we start to resemble normal life again, you know, pre-pandemic. Yeah. I think there's some trauma, not to get really dramatic, but there's some trauma associated with something like this that's going to be in people's heads still.
Oh, of course. A lot of people are not going to want to be in crowds for a long, long, long time.
Yeah.
And there's going to be a mix.
And I can't blame them.
That's what I mean. How that's just one of the many variables that I'm talking about of like, it's just going to take a minute for a lot of people. It's as strange as that first transition was, that the one coming back is, I think it's going to be weirder. Like people are so used to how life is now, kind of isolated. And a lot of people are realizing that they really like that. And there's nothing wrong with that. I can see a lot of people feeling anxiety of like the idea of, oh, I have to go back to the office. Oh, shows are coming back. We'll be in a crowd again. Going to movies, like sitting with a bunch of other people in a movie. Like there's a lot of weird emotions and anxieties about that. I get it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I've never thought about how disgusting movie theaters actually are until this pandemic. Now that you mention movie theaters, that's a whole other ball of wax. As a card carrying extrovert, though, like this has been particularly hard on me. You know, the isolation from other people. I have been going to work with other people for most of this. The first few months when everything shut down, we were shut down. But I have been going to work, so I still have my handful of people that I basically get to be around every day. But for a while there, it was very, very
difficult. What do you
do? I'm a public library director.
Oh.
So, yeah, it's something I got into. I got out of college. I needed a job. And so I started applying everywhere in the first, you know, got to pay off those loans.
Libraries are important, man. And I'm glad to see that those were one of the things that, well, I guess it's different everywhere. Like, didn't suffer too badly. There's ways for people to still get their reading on and get their hard copies.
Oh yeah,
we
definitely shifted to online.
Reading a page rather than reading on a screen or a tab. You know, it's very important. So I'm
We definitely made some transitions in the digital realm, but we as soon as we possibly could, we found a way to get physical materials in people's hands. And believe it or not, this is a soapbox I'll end up on if people don't stop me. But there's a mentality that libraries aren't needed because we have the internet to
right.
people. And I'm like, well, you know, actually, and they're like, oh, ebooks are better. Turns out millennials, of which I am an elder millennial, I refer to myself, millennials prefer real books by and large. And millennials are the number one users of public libraries right now. I'm sure we'll get passed by Gen Y eventually, but I love what I do. But it was definitely a struggle when your field, the thing you do for a living, is share things to people's homes over and over and over again, and it becomes, if you're not careful, you become a very, very dangerous place in the middle of a pandemic. And so it took us a little while to adjust to that and to get used to it. It's going to take us time to adjust back too, you know.
Yep.
I have staff right now that have never worked in a public library except during a pandemic. They don't even know what it looks like, not in a pandemic. So it'll be an interesting transition. It's a wild world. But so on the gigs thing, I played some gigs this weekend. I got a call to play guitar for a praise and worship band at a camp. And you know, they kept a lot of the protocols in place. It was pretty safe, but it was still very awkward being on stage in front of people again after so long. It's going to be an interesting, and it's got to be even more interesting being in the crowd at this point. I don't know. I'm having a hard time actually verbalizing like the awkwardness it feels.
Just anything that you're so used to doing and then you're kind of stripped away from it for such a long time to come back to it. It's just going to be, you expect it to be how it was, but it's also different because you just, all this stuff that's happened is in your head. And I get it. There's a lot of mixed emotions about it.
Absolutely. So we're not going to go through your rig or anything like I said up front. You know, if anybody wants to do that, they can go through the rig rundown. They can.
There's plenty of rundowns of my rig. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Is there anything gear wise that you've either gotten through the pandemic or you see coming out that you find really exciting? Do you tend to just have these core sounds you like and you don't push too much? Are you constantly looking for new sounds? Because you produce
as
well.
Yes to all.
Because you produce as well. You don't just play guitar and sing, but you do some producing, don't you?
I do, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes to all those things. I have my core sounds, but with my core sounds, I'm always looking to evolve. I mean, if you listen to my first record even and you listen to the new one, there's a lot of familiar sounds, a lot of the same sounds, but also different.
Yeah.
And that's just because I'm always listening to new music, new ideas, and hearing things in a different way. And if I've done something one way already, chances are I don't want it to sound the same way. I want to find another way, essentially to say the same thing, but have it come out differently. So I'm always chasing, whether it be just like miking techniques, whether it be like reverbs or delays, fuzzes, like, you know, overdrives, to me, there's only so much different sounds you can get with an overdrive. It's more about the guitar and the amp relationship that'll give you a different tone and color and really a feel. For me, overdrives, I find like I have the ones that I know, like you said, like my core sounds that work really great. It's things like fuzz and delay and just like some modular effects that, which I use very sparingly. I use them more in a recording capacity than I do live. That's where things get really interesting. And it just like inspires. I've had some songs. Okay. I should say like, I always write just like a guitar and that's it. Like no effects or anything like that. The gear doesn't define me or my sound.
Right.
But there's definitely been some times where I accidentally stepped on something and like, well, that's a cool thing. And like I inspired an idea, you know, that's important. In the pandemic, there has been a lot of gear for sure. Like, I mean, it's been a healthy year for the gear industry.
Very.
I mean, some of the guitars I was showing in the Premier Guitar one have been some new acquisitions, some guitars I'm just hanging on to, trying out that have really been great. Some of those acoustics have been getting a lot of use. Amp wise, I keep using all my same stuff. I know what I like. I know what I need to get. I need that high wattage goodness. But also for recording, it's a different ball game. I love my the few vintage Fender amps I have. Pedal wise, there's been so much. You know, those the Chase Bliss Automatone pedals are both amazing. The Poly, which I had already for a while before pandemic, is amazing. And Loki, the guy that makes it, who's a friend, he's like a mad scientist. He's always adding more sounds. I used a Fender Echo Reverb on my record, which is those oil can delay units.
Oh,
I said, dude, can you make this? Can you get this sound going? He's like, yep. Made an IR of one. He had a friend of his somewhere in Australia record an IR, and sure enough, made a sound. I said, hey, man, I got this other sound I've been using, whatever it was. It was a concoction of something from the H9 and something else. And he said, yep, I got it. He's like, and it's amazing.
It's awesome.
So there's amazing gear like that. And I'm not even a MIDI crazy guy. I like simple. In fact, I like to set something and forget it. I don't like messing too much because I don't want to feel like I'm on a computer. I want to just feel like I'm playing guitar.
Yep.
And MIDI and programming is kind of my kryptonite. So for whatever I can handle, I enjoy it. But when it gets too much, I kind of like, it's too much. It takes me out of the whole reason I'm doing it, just to like play guitar or play music.
Yeah, no, that makes a ton of sense. I had a big board at one point that was all MIDI controlled. You know, I had the ES8 and at some point I looked at it and I said, you know what? I'm spending more time programming presets than I am just playing guitar. And like I stripped it down, and I find I play more. When you play live with these sounds, and this is always fascinating to me because I know how I approach it, and I'm not, you know, on a constant tour. So when you're on the road and you're playing your music, do you know? I realize in some settings it would be this way, but it's like, okay, we're going into the chorus. That's these sounds, or the guitar solo for this song is these pedals, this sound, or do you, you know, get inspired in the midst of it all going on and, you know, hey, there wasn't fuzz on this solo. Now I'm going to fuzz it this time, or, you know.
Yeah, both. I don't like preset anything. I usually have a board with some kind of a switcher, but it's all manual. Like I, if I want that plate reverb and the fuzz, like I don't have one preset that puts both on. I do it all manually.
Yeah.
That I don't want to be tied down to a preset ever. Live, I do have my sounds that I use, like, you know, to some degrees, a lot of these parts, they're not iconic parts, but like the sound on them is signature to it.
Right.
That's the word I was going for. The signature, not iconic. You know, like it's like part of that sound is the effect on it. So I have to have that. But then sometimes, you know, like you said, yeah, normally it's fuzz, but maybe I'll just try something different. I will often, you know, sometimes you kind of get bored and you want to just switch it up a bit. I'm all for that. Basically when I'm recording, like the world's your oyster. I have my big recording board. I'll bring a bunch of pedals. I'll bring a bunch of extra stuff just in case. And then however that ends up when I'm live, I have a smaller travel board that I can actually, it's pretty powerful. Like I can basically get any of those sounds. It's just a bit more contained. You know, I usually use a tank for my trem and for plate or big spring reverbs. Obviously I don't tour with that. So that I'll use a pedal.
Right.
You know, record everything to a plate and then we use that to taste. I have a pedal that can do a really good plate. You know, I record a lot, especially on this new record. We really use the room mic a lot more than the close mics to taste. Okay. I have a sound where it can emulate more of a room sound. You know, so things like that, I will use that but often when I'm singing and entertaining and trying to remember lyrics, trying to sing in tune, trying to be funny to an audience, sometimes the last thing I'm thinking about is, I better kick on that room sound preset and, you know.
Yeah. And so you just go with what you've gotten and make it work. Yeah. So you mentioned the tank. That's the Victoria Reverberato, right? That's yeah. You mentioned that. I'm that shoulder. I'm a big Victoria fan. Mark over at Victoria makes incredible gear. I love that Reverberato, but don't have one yet. That'll happen eventually.
Great.
So This brings me to a question that I want to get your take on. It's something I actually put out a TikTok recently about it. And I'm trying to remember the story that inspired it, but musicians when they go see a band live. I want to see how much you experience this. Because it may be like on the much smaller scale, it's more common. By the time you're hitting that mid and upper tier of recording, you know, on touring and those kinds of things. Musicians tend to go see bands live, and after shows, they want to talk to musicians, and they end up talking about gear, and they don't talk about the music they make. And I'm seeing that mindset. I've seen that mindset a lot at small gigs and locally. Do you experience that a lot? Do you find it guitarists will come up and just want to talk to you about your gear?
Well, it's the classic musician to musician compliment. For some reason, some musicians have a really hard time complimenting somebody. I don't know if it's a competitive thing or if it's like they just have a weird thing. They can't just go, "Great set, man. I love the way you play. I love that. You were so good." A lot of musicians, they can't help themselves, but they just go, "Great set, man. That guitar, that Strat sounds amazing." And, you know, for some people, that's their way of complimenting. And some people can't bring themselves to literally compliment the person. I make a point. The gear, for lack of a better term, doesn't fucking matter.
Right. You know,
it only sounds good from the person that's playing it. So, you know, I always say, I don't talk about gear if I'm at a show, especially if it's friends or someone I really respect. The last thing I want to talk about is the equipment. I want to just compliment them and let them know how much I enjoyed what they do. So much work goes into writing and performing songs and putting on a show.
Yes.
The gear is just tools. You don't go to an electrician and be like, "Oh man, I love how you wired up that basement. Your tool belt that you're wearing is sick, bro." It's just like, what? No, you say, "Thanks. You did such a good job. You know, the breaker is perfect. Nothing's shorting out. Nothing's killing the breaker. Everything's powered up. It's great. Thank you for doing such a great job." You know, like that's what it's about. And it's the same thing. Gear is huge in the music community, and especially with guitar players. Like, people just love that shit. You know what? That's fine. I know a lot of my audience associate me with, "Oh, pedal show. Oh, Anderton's. Oh, I saw you demo that pedal once. Oh, I saw you do that." And you know what? If someone comes to a show of mine and says, "Hey, I saw you demo that 335 on Carter Vintage or something, and I'm here," I go, "Thanks for being here. Hell yeah. I don't care."
Yeah.
It brought you. I don't care where you saw me from. The fact that you're here is what matters.
Yeah. For example, I first discovered you through
Anderson. If they associate and they want to talk about the gear side, you know, it is what it is. It's all good. I don't judge. Me personally, it's not about the gear. It's about the art and the music. Right. So, and for anyone listening, if you want to make someone feel appreciated, don't compliment the gear, compliment their hands or compliment their voice or their sing. You know, compliment them.
Yeah.
It goes a long way.
That was where I was getting it in my TikTok. It was, I want especially musicians, especially guitarists, as a self-professed someone who loves gear and loves talking about it. I want to normalize musicians talking to other musicians about the art they create and not the thing they bought. Like literally, I've got guitars. You're going to compliment me on the thing I went to a store and picked up and not on the thing that I created. And I don't care if they're in a cover band. I don't care if they're doing original music. I don't care if, you know, talk to them about the thing they're doing, not the thing they ordered from Sweetwater, you know?
Don't get me wrong. You could hear someone playing and be like, a sound or a tone can move you.
Sure.
And it doesn't necessarily have to be about the playing. And that, you know, there are scenarios where that does make sense to say, "Man, you really just rocked me with that, whatever that sound was. I remembered that, like the sound really moved something inside." You know, like there's a time and place for all of that stuff. It's all good. And it's really about the circle that you hang out in. most of my friends and colleagues, everyone enjoys gear and loves it. But I mean, there's bigger fish to fry. It's about the art. It's about the writing, the singing, the, you know?
Yeah, no, I think that's true. I see so many people hung up on the gear. And for example, when this podcast started, that was a big thing I thought I was going to focus on. And then as I've interviewed and talked to folks, I've realized, you know, I don't actually care as much about the gear as I thought I did. I like gear, but I don't want to talk about it week in and week out. I want to talk about the music that people are creating. For example, that's why I really wanted to lead off when we were talking about your album. We've mentioned it a whole bunch. It sounds phenomenal.
Thank you.
It's something that I haven't hit enough plays yet to give you one count according to Going Gold or anything. What's it, like 15? I remember how many plays it takes to get digital streams to go platinum. I saw a podcast or listened to a podcast recently where someone talked about it. Something
10 million or something like that.
Oh, it's completely
for a song.
I think it's even more. I think it's like 1,500 streams is the equivalent of one purchase. And so whatever that math works out to, it's ridiculous.
Well, a million streams is about, like, financially, I think it's $3,000 or $4,000 only.
God, that's so absurd. It's so absurd.
All good. Time we live in, whatever.
And that's as someone who streams music, and I get it. And there's something to be said for the direct distribution tools that it gives the, you know, the independent musician compared to the big touring or the recording artist or even those on independent labels. But there's also, there's some things that need fixing for it. That's why I promise I'm going to put this on a t-shirt at some point. It says streaming doesn't pay shit. And cause on this podcast, I've encouraged people when they like one of my guests to go find their music, buy a physical copy, buy something, a t-shirt, hat, I don't care, you know, just go support them in a way that's not streaming their music. And so I make it a point to encourage that. Sorry, I went on a complete tangent there. Cause I get real frustrated with it, but also
no problem.
So I've been listening to it over and over again. So those songs were all written pre-pandemic. You've written a bunch since then. You've probably got, I think I heard you say, but you've got a handful of songs ready to go. How far in advance do you start planning an album when you're getting ready to record one?
Not as far in advance as you think. The writing is what takes long. Like my first record, I wrote the first song, I want to say about a year before I was in the studio.
Oh, wow.
So I wrote for about a year. And then how long? Like, I was on tour in the UK. I've told this story a million times as well, but I was on tour in the UK in February 2018. And, you know, it was like really my first actual tour as me.
Right. I
toured plenty as not me. I was touring with Josh Smith in the UK, and it was just going so well. I was in London looking for a shirt because I spilled coffee over mine at a clinic I was doing that day. And I knew that I was going back to Winnipeg the next month to produce a record for someone else. And I just had this moment of like, you know, this is going so well. I'm kind of riding this currently. If I don't do this record ASAP, I might never do it. So I called my producer, who was also a co-writer on some of the tunes. And I said, man, if we don't do this now, I don't know if I'm ever going to do it. Let's just do this. And sure enough, I produced this record for someone for 4 or 5 days. The next day we reset and started my record. So, I mean, that was that process. For this next record, the second I finished How Long, like sign off on masters, sign off on artwork, send it to print. That was like mid summer 2018. once I have that like burden off of my mind and I'm like, okay, I don't have to write or worry about that music anymore, I can start working on new stuff. That's when I start. So it was basically a year and a half of writing and touring a lot for that record. Sorry, for those new songs. And I think this time we recorded in December 2019. By August, I had already started making the plans, so to speak, and just, you know, I booked the studio time, I made the plan, booked my musicians, and we started doing pre-production just like 2 weeks before we went into the studio. For those that don't know what that is, that's just making sure all the songs are picked, making sure the songs that are picked are in as good shape as possible, just arrangement-wise, lyrically, musically, and then we hit it. So it's different. It's always different. I mean, like, as long as you have the songs, it's not you don't really need the lead-up time, in my opinion. It's more about just logistics, making sure everyone's available, making sure everything's set up the way it needs to be. If people are coming in from out of town, or if you're at this place, or if you're that place, or if this is just logistics.
Yeah, no, it makes sense. You were talking about the pre-production, and I couldn't help but think back to the days when, you know, musicians would go or artists would go into the studio, maybe a handful of songs, no arrangements. They'd arrange, they'd finish writing in the studio. And you think back to some of these super expensive, you know, $2,000 a day studios that they're doing this in, and I don't know. It's interesting how different the process is now, for a lot of artists.
Yeah, people are still doing that way. I think it's really cool. I've been a part of many sessions in the past couple of years, even on albums I was on, where we started a song that was kind of slightly arranged, or even an album where like the songs were picked, but like there was no pre-production. We kind of figured it out as we went along, and it took a few takes. Some songs where someone had a verse idea, and we eventually just in the moment turned it into an arrangement, and it was kind of like, well, figure out chorus, melody, and lyrics later.
You figure it all out later. Lay
down, it still happens.
That's cool.
That's kind of the fun part about the studio, is like there's no rule book. There's no right or wrong way to do it. It's just whatever works for you, and whatever works in the moment. I don't know if I'm OCD or if I'm a little too organized. I think I'd be way too stressed out to show up unprepared, so to speak, like not knowing what was going to happen. Like whenever I write for an album, I'll demo it. Like I'll demo a full song so that when we're doing pre-production, there's a recording of it already that gives a very clear idea of how I'm hearing it, how the arrangement should be. And it's all subject to change, but sure, like the foundation is there, and it just helps the workflow. It just helps everybody have a clear idea. Oh, I see. Cool. Bass player kind of has any drums, know what to do. It just saves a lot of time, and it saves a lot of fishing around for the idea. But the fishing around can also sometimes be really fun. It can really be awesome, the ideas that come up. And sometimes in the moment, it's awesome. And then when you're done, it's not that great.
Sure.
That's why I say there's no right or wrong way, because it depends on the moment and the people.
Yeah.
And the song, of course.
Well, yeah, I guess you don't have to have a song based on what we're saying, but it's good to have a starting place and a song that's, you know, worth the story worth telling before you do any of the others.
Yeah.
I listened to a really great songwriter's podcast called The Working Songwriter, and it's interesting to hear some of those stories of songwriters working and their process and demoing. And so when you demo things, are they just guitar and voice demos? Do you tend to lay out parts for other instruments? How fleshed out are your demos before you get ready to go in?
Well, I try to flesh it out as much as I can. I'll record guitars, bass, I'll program drums, or I'll have someone play some drums, and I try to come up with an arrangement. But the thing is that a lot of people, there's a thing called demoitis, and demoitis is when you put all this time and effort into a demo, and then when you get to the recording session of doing it the actual way, you're so tied to the demo that you can't kind of break away from it, and that can sometimes hinder your experience. So I make a full demo, but like the guitar playing, it'll just be first take. You know, there's going to be some flubs. Vocals, first take, like not awesome in any way. And that motivates me, because the song and the idea and the arrangement is there. But each time I listen to it, I go, oh, right, I can sing this so much better. Oh, I'll be playing that so much better. It inspires me to like do it the right way, rather than if I put all this time and effort into just a demo.
Yeah.
Then I would feel like I already put this work in. Why do I have to do it again for the actual recording?
Yeah.
So if that makes sense.
As opposed to this thing that maybe 10 different people are going to hear in the entire life of it before you record the real version.
Yeah, the demo is just for me.
Yeah.
It's for sending out to the players, like my band members, to go, hey, here's how we're going to do it. That's all it's for. Nothing more, nothing less.
I've not heard that term demoitis, but I can definitely understand. You don't want to, you put too much effort and too much of you into this thing that isn't meant to be, you know, that involved. It's just, it's your roadmap. This
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah,
this is your sketch. Hung up on it.
Yeah. No, that's awesome. So, gonna start to wrap up here. I really appreciate you coming on. I really appreciate you sitting down talking with me. Especially, it was short notice. You turned around real quick. It means a whole bunch to me. Again, I'm a fan of the music, so I'm trying not to like just be a fan and try to be serious about the interview. But I really appreciate it. Headway is amazing. Y'all make sure y'all go out and listen to it.
Thanks, man.
You can find it obviously on Spotify, but remember it doesn't pay shit. So go find, Ariel's website, which I'm going to link. If you can send me any other links to anywhere that they can find you. So, but I'm going to give you a chance because I'm on social media.
I'll tell you this, honestly, we're all trying to make money here, but like the money isn't as important with streaming to me as the quality of sound is. And yeah, obviously if you buy a record or a CD, that's the best, but Spotify and all the streaming, they really suck out the life of your songs, like sonically speaking. If you want, like, if you don't want to buy a record, but you want like high quality lossless audio, go to Bandcamp. arielposen.bandcamp.com. Buy the record. Cool. It's like very high quality, as it's supposed to sound compared to on like Spotify or anything. But even if you listen to it on Spotify and that's your preference, thanks for listening. All good.
Yeah, exactly. It's all listening. It's all awesome. I'll be having a vinyl headed my way. Cause I'm at a point now where I don't buy CDs anymore. I either stream, and if I really want to support the artist, I'll buy the vinyl because it sounds better. I have a record player here at home and one at my office at work. So I'll play records.
Don't really make CD players anymore. You can't even get them in computers or cars anymore. So, I mean, it's a dying art.
Yeah.
Some people still mess with it, but not really.
Yeah. I've still got a ton. I look over here as if they're over here anymore. I moved them. They're all in boxes now. I don't ever pull them out anymore, but, it doesn't sound the same. I don't care what anybody says. Everybody's like, oh, it sounds better. And da da da. No, there's something about the record, the vinyl, the scratchiness and everything aside, you know, it comes across more authentically to me. That's being ridiculous and esoteric, but,
no, it does.
There's a vibe to it.
It really makes it a listening experience too.
Yeah. There's a ritual to it that I appreciate of taking a record, this inconvenient hunk of plastic, and putting it on a clunky giant thing compared to what we're used to. You know, we're used to things, our phones this size being our music players. There's a buy-in to having this giant piece of equipment take up space in your living space that is just for playing these inconvenient four songs to a side pieces of, you know, nostalgia.
Yeah.
And I love that ritual. I love that take on it. So I'm going to put links to Bandcamp. I'll put a link to Spotify, link to website. Also, they can find you on Instagram, YouTube. I don't know if you mess around too much with any other social medias, anywhere else.
People, I'm on everything. I'm easy to find, just at Ariel Posen.
Gotcha. Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, y'all, I really appreciate you listening. I really appreciate y'all hanging out. And I really appreciate Ariel Posen for coming on and talking, indulging me in some of my questions that I know can be a little tedious, because I'm really fascinated in the songwriter side of things. Remember that you can find 40 Watt Podcast on YouTube, Instagram, Facebook. You can find us on Patreon if you want to support the show, as I said before. But we're going to sign off. So until next time, I want y'all to be good to yourselves, be good to other people, and make a little bit of noise. See y'all.
This episode is brought to you by the supporters of 40 Watt Podcast over on Patreon. Go over to patreon.com/40wattpodcast, where for as little as $3 per month, you can help support the podcast and get every episode ad-free. For $5 a month, you'll get every episode ad-free, as well as a bonus episode every week. I can't overstate how thankful I am for the support of my patrons, and hope you'll consider joining the team and helping keep this show on the road.